nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Hello, this is Tim Fisher. I'm currently on sabbatical at the Jawaharlal Nehru Center for Advanced Scientific Research in Bangalore, India. I'm recording this lecture for the Nanotechnology 501 seminar series for students, faculty back at Purdue, and for posting onto the NanoHub and to a new hub called Thermal Hub that is focused on the heat transfer community. The topic will be heat transfer across solid contacts with some enhancement from nanomaterials, specifically carbon nanotubes. I'll start the talk with brief motivation, drawing mainly from the semiconductor industry and the thermal management problems that they're encountering. Then I'll proceed to describe the fundamental theory of contact resistance. This is thermal contact resistance that I will address. I'll talk about how we would model it and measure it both. Then in the third part of the talk, I'll explain what we've done with carbon nanotubes and try to describe how we've interpreted the results and what might be happening and what physics are dominating the transport process through the interface. And then I'll have some brief conclusions at the end. This is a slide from Ravi Mahajan at Intel, and essentially what it says is that the size, the physical size, the volume of systems, of computer systems, has been shrinking for some time, from the PC tower down to the small PCs and even going away from the desktop, looking at handheld electronics and portable electronics more generally. And yet at the same time, the power dissipation has been increasing substantially from Pentium 3 up through the modern generations, and it has leveled out more recently. But nevertheless, this has put a huge strain on thermal systems because we generally have less volume to work with to design thermal solutions into, and we have more power to dissipate. That means that we have to have much higher airflow rates, and we have to use the volume more wisely so that we're putting heat dissipating components into that space. I'm going to address one part of the thermal solution today, and that is the thermal interface material. We're going to talk about thermal contact conductance and resistance more generally. But to motivate the subject, consider the picture here where we have a couple of key places where we have solid-to-solid interfaces with possibly a filler material between. One is between the chip and the case, and the other one is between the case and the heatsink. And in both of these instances, having efficient heat flow is critical to the performance of the device. And there's actually been quite a bit of progress made over the last decade or so in reducing the thermal interface resistance by about tenfold, from 100 units of resistance in millimeters squared Kelvin per watt to about 10. And there's also been some very good metrology developments along the way. And the new opportunities now are in applying nanomaterials, and that will comprise the last part of the talk today. So for the next few slides, I'll talk about the fundamental theory of contact resistance from a traditional standpoint, and later we'll talk about some of the subcontinuum considerations that we have to make for the materials that we're using in the lab. So the first issue that we should deal with is defining what is contact resistance, and the essence of it is that it's a resistance to heat transfer caused by an interface, and this interface poses, or an interface poses, resistance to heat transfer because of imperfections, typically, in the mating of two surfaces. And the thermal interface resistance, or contact resistance, is manifest by a virtual temperature jump across the interface, and this temperature jump is typically not physical, meaning there's no actual discontinuity in the temperature field, but instead it's a difference between the extrapolated linear portions of the temperature fields in the body of the two solids at the interface. And then there's a curvature in the temperature field very near the interface that's caused by local contact spots, by imperfect contact between the two materials, such that the heat has to channel into finite-sized contacts. Many factors affect contact resistance. The contact geometry is very important. In particular, surface roughness and waviness are critical factors. Also, thermal and other physical properties of the material are important, of the solids themselves, of the filler material between the two solids. The applied pressure is important. That determines what type of modeling we would use, whether we would assume elastic or plastic deformation. And the interface temperature can have an effect as well, because properties can be temperature dependent, and if we're talking about subcontinuum effects, the changes in phonon occupation number can become important. Now, ideally, what we would do is we would take this interface and we would fill it with a material that had infinite thermal conductivity. If we did that, then the thermal resistance, the contact resistance, would tend toward zero because, as you see in the bottom left equation, the thermal resistance is simply the bond line thickness divided by the thermal conductivity. So what we would like to have would be a filler material with very high conductivity. In general, there are several modes of heat transfer that could be important in a given problem. Conduction has already been discussed, but in this context, both conduction through the solid and through the interstitial medium could be important. Radiation typically is not important because the temperature differences are not high enough and the absolute temperatures are not high enough. And the same is true of convection. There just isn't enough room to set up convective currents. On this slide, I'm giving a number of definitions that will be important to remember to some extent. The first is the heat transfer coefficient that we use for convection. The units are the same, and the principles are too. It essentially is the ratio between the heat flux and the temperature difference. In this case, that temperature difference is the temperature jump, which is a virtual temperature difference. The inverse of thermal contact conductance is the resistance, and that's what's used more commonly. And it is, in this case, given on a per unit area basis, so that its units are millimeters squared Kelvin per watt. If I divide by the area, then I get a resistance in degrees Kelvin per watt, which is also used occasionally. Contact resistance can actually be calculated, at least in part, through diffusive principles. So if we solve Laplace's equation in a half space, we can find a constriction resistance, that is the resistance that occurs because of heat channeling into a circular contact in this case. And it turns out that if we solve Laplace's equation, we find that we can express the solution for temperature in terms of Bessel functions, and then the actual final solution depends on what the boundary condition is over this region of the half space surface that is exposed. So we either could have a uniform temperature boundary condition there or a uniform heat flux condition, and then everywhere else we would assume that the interface is insulated. Well, that Bessel function solution isn't very difficult to deal with, and if we integrate over the area to find the heat flow, or we take an average temperature in the case of a fixed heat flow or heat flux at the surface, then we can calculate a thermal resistance, a constriction resistance in this case, that's defined as a temperature rise that occurs because of the constriction itself. And the expression is very simple for it. It's 1 divided by a constant times K, the thermal conductivity, times A, which is the radius of the circular disk that represents the contact. Now, if I choose to have a uniform temperature or a uniform heat flux, the difference in the calculated resistance is small. It's within about 10%, and so commonly people use the uniform temperature result because it has an integer constant, so it's 1 divided by 4 times thermal conductivity times that contact spot radius. Now, in reality, for real surfaces, this half space doesn't fit quite right because it assumes that the heat flow is not constrained by heat flow in other regions. So what Cooper did in 1969 was to come up with something called the constriction alleviation factor, and in essence we can view this interface as a series of side-by-side heat flux tubes, each of which has their own contact spot at along the axis. And by taking this concept, Cooper showed that we can actually use the half-space result for resistance pre-multiplied by this constriction alleviation factor, and that constriction alleviation is related to the contact spot radius A and the flux tube radius B, as shown in the equation on the bottom right. This slide shows diffusive heat flow in a somewhat different way. We have an energy-carrying particle, a phonon or an electron, that's moving through a medium, and every so often it collides or scatters off of another particle or off of another energy carrier. And this is an overly simplified view. It's a cartoon, of course, but it gives you the idea that if a energy-carrying particle starts inside of a diffusive heat flux line, then it will make its way through the contact spot, at least according to diffusion theory. And then we can define a thermal conductivity as K equal to a specific heat C multiplied by a velocity of this carrier, that's V sub G, and then multiplied by the mean free path, lambda, and we divide all of that by 3, and that's a very classic kinetic result for thermal conductivity. However, if the mean free path lambda of the carrier becomes comparable to or larger than the contact spot size, then an energy-carrying particle that might start in between two diffusive heat flux lines that terminate at the contact spot or inside of the contact spot, that particle is not guaranteed to make it through the contact anymore because it's not scattering frequently enough, so it could cross over those diffusive heat flux lines and strike the interface and scatter back into the medium from which it came. And this effect causes an additional resistance. We'll call it a ballistic resistance, and the characteristic non-dimensional quantity that governs this resistance is the Knudsen number, defined as the mean free path lambda divided by the contact spot radius A. This slide gives an overview of some of the issues involved with calculating this ballistic resistance. First of all, in this case, if ballistic resistance is important, then we'll have a contact spot size A that's comparable to or smaller than the phonon mean free path. And then the other factors that will be important are the phonon group velocity, the density of states of phonons, and the transmissivity. And in general, this kind of transport process through a contact or through an aperture can be described through kinetic theory, and that's what's shown at the bottom here. We can make some assumptions about the phonon dynamics. We can use the Debye model, assuming a constant group velocity. We use Bose-Einstein statistics for phonons, and then we could have a transmissivity that depends on both frequency and direction. So it can be a fairly complicated calculation to make. However, at least to first order, we can use a simple approximation where we just take the mean free path, or an average mean free path, divide it by the area that forms the Knudsen number, and then the ballistic resistance, if you calculate the integral from the previous page with some assumptions about the transmission, becomes just a factor involving the thermal conductivity K and the contact radius A in the denominator multiplied by the Knudsen number. So it looks very similar to the diffusive resistance. If you'll recall, that was 1 divided by 4 times thermal conductivity times contact spot radius. So this is, in essence, a number comparable to that one, then multiplied by the Knudsen number. So if I have a Knudsen number that is large, much greater than 1, then that resistance will be dominant for the interface. And Again, a first-order type of approximation is just to add the diffusive and the ballistic resistances together. This is not physically rigorous necessarily, but it's commonly done in the literature. And looking ahead to the carbon nanotube interfaces that we will discuss later or review later, the Knudsen number for those interfaces is about 100, which means that, roughly speaking, the ballistic resistance is about 100 times greater than the diffusive resistance. So in this additive approximation, the ballistic resistance is the one that dominates, and in fact the diffusive resistance can be neglected entirely. We'll turn our attention now briefly to experimental methods to determine contact conductance and resistance. And kind of a brute force method is to set up a system of one-dimensional heat transfer and then measure the temperature gradients in test specimens with known thermal conductivity, and then extrapolate the linear portions of those temperature fields to the interface to infer the temperature jump, and then the known temperature fields of the two blocks can be used to infer the heat flow or heat flux through the bars. So the heat flux across the interface, and knowing the temperature jump and the heat flux gives you the thermal resistance or conductance. We've used this approach quite commonly. We've taken some extra measures compared to the usual techniques and actually put our setup inside a vacuum and viewed the system with an infrared camera through a germanium viewport. But the setups are shown here. On the right side, I have two blocks that are making contact in the geometric middle or center. And on the top, I have a heater that sends heat through the system from top to bottom. And on the bottom, I have a temperature-controlled chilled water cooler. And so once we have this system set up, we can put our test specimen between these two reference bars that are painted black so that we have known emissivity for the infrared measurements. This slide gives you an example of the types of results that we see. On the left, we see a visual image of the temperature contours and also a graphical image of the of several lines that are drawn in magenta in that infrared image. The one with the black symbols and lines shows the line that crosses the interface, and you can see there clearly a temperature jump. And then in the graph on the right, that temperature jump is shown with more clarity, and we see some scatter around the interface that's due to both the presence of the sample itself between the two bars and the presence of some fiducial marks that give us an ability to measure distance in order to calculate gradients. So the entire system can be viewed as a series of thermal resistances, and in essence what we're doing is we're measuring the total resistance from the top to the bottom, and our primary interest is at the interface itself. But if I put a sample between two reference bars, then actually I have two interfaces, not one, and that proves to be perhaps the Achilles heel of this approach. But we need to resolve each of these resistances with very small uncertainty in order to have a reasonably good experimental result at the end of this process. Experimental uncertainty for this technique with these two interfaces is quite high, and largely because we have a control experiment that we have to include in the results because we are testing two interfaces, not one at a time. And so we have an inherent uncertainty in the overall resistance calculation from a single experiment, and then when we do another experiment to subtract out the control, then we have to add that uncertainty as well. And so if you look at some of the mathematics, some of the additive errors, they can be quite significant, and I'll show you that in a bit with some of the results that we've measured by a couple of different techniques. There are a number of excellent transient measurements for contact resistance and thermal properties more generally. The photoacoustic method actually dates back to the 1800s with Alexander Graham Bell, and It's been popularized more recently by Sean Fanshu and others, and we've used it to good effect in measuring some of the interfaces with carbon nanotube interfaces, measuring some of our carbon nanotube interfaces. Other transient measurements include photoreflectance, photothermal, and 3-omega methods. They each have their benefits and their drawbacks. The photoacoustic measurement technique is quite robust, and this work is done primarily in Sean Fanshu's lab at Purdue. A faculty colleague of mine and the student working on this is Bara Kola. And in essence, what happens is we set up an interface, and around it we place a chamber that has optical access so that we can put a heating laser through the top, and it also has acoustic access, a microphone that is embedded in a port of the chamber. And then we can pressurize the chamber to change the pressure of the interface itself, and we use a pulsed laser beam, and the pulse frequency can change, but in essence what happens is that there's a thermal piston effect where we heat the surface, and that in turn heats the gas, which causes a change in pressure that is recorded by the microphone. To use this technique, we have to actually sweep across different frequencies so that we can interrogate different levels of the substrate beneath the heated surface. So in essence, we have a thermal model of the subsurface structure below the heating laser, and we use that model and the frequency-dependent temperature response to estimate the thermal properties, whether they be thermal conductivities or thermal resistances, of the sample structure itself. This frequency modulation, in essence, allows us to interrogate different depths beneath this surface, and so we can look at both interfaces and bulk materials in the same structure. I'm now going to turn my attention to carbon nanotube thermal interfaces. We've done some interesting work in this area, and I'll relate some of our recent results to some of the principles that I introduced earlier in the talk. This slide, which was actually made by Bara Kola and Placidus Amama, shows different types of carbon that can be, a solid carbon that can be fabricated or appear naturally, and they range from diamond to graphite to buckyballs to carbon nanotubes. And each one of these materials, I believe, in its own right, is quite interesting, and carbon is quite an amazing material if you think about all of the different forms it takes and the different properties that it exhibits. Our attention will focus on carbon nanotubes, and I'm going to assume that most people know at least a little bit about carbon nanotubes. What I'm showing here are the two basic forms of carbon nanotubes. The top image shows a single-walled carbon nanotube, which is, in essence, a graphene plane that is rolled up and connected into a shell, a cylinder with just one wall of carbon atoms. The bottom figure shows what's called a multi-walled carbon nanotube, and in this case we have multiple shells that are rolled together as one into one cylinder. Our interest in this particular application is mainly on multi-walled carbon nanotubes, primarily because we want that contact spot radius A to be reasonably large so that we can fit phonons into the structures. Carbon nanotubes are intriguing for this application for many reasons, actually, and some of them are somewhat surprising. The most obvious is that they have very high thermal conductivity, at least axially. The room temperature thermal conductivity of carbon nanotubes is around 3,000. It's been measured by many different people and in many different ways with actually quite a range of results. But in essence, it's in the thousands. The thermal conductivity is in the thousands of watts per meter Kelvin, and that's about 10 times larger than most metal materials, and about the same as what you'd find in diamond. And so that is the first motivating factor to use carbon nanotubes in a thermal application. They're also a ballistic electron conductor, at least within shorter lengths of tubes, at room temperature, but phonons actually dominate the thermal conductivity, so the electronic properties are not all that important in this particular application, although we've studied many of the electronic applications, including for interfaces in my group. Another property that's interesting is the high aspect ratios, and this allows carbon nanotubes to fit into small spaces and crevices that you find in interfaces. They're also very mechanically resilient. They have a high Young's modulus, and they have low bending resistance, which makes them suitable for conforming to these interfaces. They also have very strong van der Waals interactions with other materials and with each other, and so that can potentially increase true contact area, and they're also chemically stable within reason up to fairly high temperatures. We use microwave plasma CVD primarily because it allows us a lot of flexibility in the types of processes that we can run and the temperature ranges of synthesis, and in addition we can use the system to grow diamond, which is another interesting thermal material. What we do with this system is we vary different process gas compositions. Primarily we're using hydrogen as the main gas and methane as the carbon-containing species. We sometimes put in nitrogen. We vary a number of different parameters during operation, from the microwave plasma power to the pressure to the substrate temperature to the substrate bias. And we've had fairly good success in controlling the synthesis process by adjusting these parameters. We've been able to grow on a number of different substrates. They're listed here. I won't belabor them, but I'll just talk about some of the more interesting ones. We've grown recently on silicon carbide, actually on the carbon face of silicon carbide, and found some interesting gradient morphologies there. We've grown on diamond. We have grown on foils. Those are the bottom two images in the last two columns. On this slide, I list some of the characteristics of the nanotubes that we grow. We typically have full coverage of carbon nanotubes. It creates a black velvet type of surface from a macroscopic perspective. We commonly have very uniform layer thicknesses for a given array. We can grow actually taller than 100 microns, but typically we try to match the surface roughness of the materials that we're trying to use in these interface experiments. So 10 to 20 microns is a more typical growth height for us. We have seen evidence of strong bonding or anchoring of our nanotubes to the substrate. The SEM image in the top right shows that when we separated, in this case, instead of the nanotubes pulling off of the growth substrate, they actually fractured in the middle, which suggests that they are reasonably well anchored. And we typically have a vertically oriented macrostructure of our carbon nanotube arrays, and we have diameters in the range of 5 to 90 nanometers. We don't dial in one specific diameter, but we can control the range of diameters within reason. On this slide, I'll show three different types of interfaces that we've studied, and later I'll show you results from each. The first type is what we're calling a one-sided interface, where we grow carbon nanotubes on a substrate, and then we take a different solid and we mate the two together. It's a very simple interface. The other type is where we grow carbon nanotubes on the first substrate and then also grow separately on the second substrate, and then we bring the two together in kind of a Velcro type of way. The third style is the carbon nanotube foil interface that I talked about before, and here we actually grow the arrays on both sides of the foil at the same time, and then we use that structure as an insert between two other solids and create an interface in that way. And on the bottom here I show scanning electron micrographs of the different styles of interfaces. The bottom left shows a one-sided interface after the test, and the striations in the carbon nanotubes are actually from the machining marks of the copper surface that was mated to these carbon nanotubes. These particular nanotubes were grown on silicon, so in this case they anchored very well to the silicon instead of staying with the copper when the interface was separated. The middle structure shows some interpenetration between multi-wall carbon nanotube arrays grown on copper and silicon, and then the bottom right image shows a foil image once again. This slide contains a summary of results from our work, and on the right side we have a list of some of the publications related. And here I just want to talk briefly about orders of magnitude. If we just had a silicon copper interface with a typical machined copper surface, and we measured the interface resistance, we would find that the value or the magnitude of the resistance is in the hundreds of millimeters squared Kelvin per watt. Then if we add a one-sided interface, so grow carbon nanotubes on the silicon and then mate with copper, we see that that interface resistance decreases by more than an order of magnitude and puts us in the regime of state-of-the-art commercial materials, at least for non-bonded interfaces. So here I'm talking about waxes and greases. Then if we use the foil interface, there's actually an improvement beyond the one-sided interface, enabled, we believe, by the ability of the foil itself as a substrate to conform to an interface. And there's a further reduction in interface resistance enabled by the foil. And then that two-sided Velcro-like interface is the one that has the lowest interface resistance at about 4 millimeters squared Kelvin per watt, which is an extraordinarily low interface resistance, particularly given the fact that it's a non-bonded interface and it's separable and can be reattached. One very interesting thing that a student that I co-advised with, Sean Fanshu, the student's name is Baracola, was able to do in his PhD work is to actually resolve intra-interface resistances from within an overall interface. So here I'm showing results for a one-sided interface, carbon nanotubes grown on silicon and then mated with copper. And what Barra was able to do is to resolve resistances within the carbon nanotube substrate layers. And here I'll start with the silicon carbon nanotube interface. There, the resistance is very small, about 1.7 millimeters squared Kelvin per watt. That's the interface on which the carbon nanotubes were grown, so we expect reasonably good bonding there. Then moving to the middle, the effective thermal resistance of the carbon nanotube layer itself, you'll see, is negligibly small. So in fact, it turns out that the high thermal conductivity of the carbon nanotubes themselves is not that important, at least in terms of decreasing the bulk resistance of the interface material, because that resistance is already negligible. In fact, the highest resistance and the dominant resistance in this case occurs at the interface between the free carbon nanotube tips and the solid surface to which it mates, in this case copper, and that resistance is about 14 millimeters squared Kelvin per watt, which is almost the entire resistance itself. Moving on to two-sided interfaces, here I'm showing a comparison of results obtained by two different experimental methods. The black diamond symbols show results from the 1D reference bar technique and the error bars, and then the blue triangle show results from the photoacoustic measurement. And in this case, you'll see that the photoacoustic technique has much lower uncertainty and much better consistency, and so it clearly is a better approach for this application as compared to the 1D reference bar technique, at least. Looking further at that two-sided interface, Barra was able to also resolve intra-interface resistances for this Velcro-type structure, and he found very similar results to what we found in the one-sided interface. Specifically, the local resistances at the growth substrates are very small, and they're of order 1 millimeter squared Kelvin per watt. The effective resistance of the carbon nanotube layers themselves are negligible, and the highest, though not the dominant resistance in this case, but the highest resistance happens at the location where the carbon nanotubes meet from opposing sides. And there the resistance is about double that at the growth substrate. Well, we're quite interested in modeling this phenomenon and modeling the results that we've obtained. And it's not a simple problem at all. In fact, it's quite complicated. If you look at the possibilities of how the carbon nanotubes can actually make contact with their growth substrate or with the opposing substrate or with each other, there's almost an infinite array of possibilities, and analyzing each one would be very difficult. What we've decided to do is to take a step back and start with an approach where we could find an effective contact area, and then from there apply some of the modeling principles that I discussed earlier. And what we found is that that actually the textile industry has looked at problems similar to this. So the deformation of wool fibers is a problem that's been studied, that was studied long ago, half a century ago or more. And there was a relationship that was developed between pressure and the thickness of a mat of wool fibers. And so there was it's a cubic relation, as shown in the equation at the top right. And using that as a basis of a contact model, and there are a few constants. There's a constant C that depends on orientation and packing density and some other factors. And we also have to do some estimating of the volume of carbon nanotubes in the array. But this gives us at least a shot at having a macroscopic model for this interface. So once we have a model in mind, it's interesting to look at the actual interface to see if its mechanics are consistent. And so what we've done is we've visualized the deformation of a carbon nanotube array film as two solid materials are brought together. And here we show the beginning of the engagement where the nanotubes bend in one mode collectively, in essence. And then as we increase that force further and the deformation further, we see a buckling phenomenon occur as we would expect in this wool fiber deformation theory. So this at least gives us some qualitative evidence that we're on the right track with our contact model. Once we have a contact model, we need to relate it to our thermal model, which can be very complicated. We have billions of carbon nanotubes in a given experiment. And so what we've done here is we've actually created a fairly simple resistance network in which we have a carbon nanotube growth substrate, and at each contact point, basically at each base of a carbon nanotube, we have a diffusive and a ballistic resistance, and we have N of these per unit area, capital N. And these parallel resistances feed an effective carbon nanotube array resistance, and we can estimate that resistance with some measurements in the literature. But as I showed before, that resistance actually is very small. And then we look at the other side where we could have also ballistic and diffusive resistances on the opposing substrate, or between the carbon nanotubes and the opposing substrate, and we would have to know the number of contact spots, lowercase n, which might be different than the number of contact spots on the growth substrate. So we have to account for all of these factors and do it in a way where we are retaining at least the core physics. Well, we've applied this model, and I don't have time to go through all the detail, but in essence what we do is we use this deformation theory to determine the number of contact spots and to estimate the number of contact spots and the contact area. Once we have those, then we apply thermal models, and as I said before, the ballistic phonon resistance is the one that dominates in this arrangement. And we've applied this to a number of different data sets that we've recorded over the past several years. However, we do need to have two adjustable parameters for a given interface. One is that constant C, which depends on C and T orientation, possibly the defect density. And the second factor is T0, which is the undeformed thickness, which we actually have a pretty good idea of because we can infer it from scanning electron micrographs, but we use that as an adjustable parameter and then compare it to our images, and they're typically very consistent. What is shown on this slide is a collection of data from single-sided interfaces to two-sided interfaces. Actually, the two-sided interface is the red set of data at the bottom. And you can see that there's almost no pressure dependence for that set as compared to the single-sided interfaces. And actually, that's predicted. It comes directly out of this wool deformation theory because we can treat the two-sided interface as two sets of deformable fibers, and so its pressure dependence is very weak because those fibers are absorbing so much of the deformation. We're very pleased with the ability of this model to capture the trends shown here. So, to wrap up this talk, thermal interfaces are very important, and we need to find ways to achieve ultra-high conductance while still retaining good mechanical compliance, the ability to withstand thermal stress in use environments in the field. Carbon nanotube arrays show quite a bit of promise in this regard. Metrology is a significant challenge for all thermal interfaces, and I showed you the work out of Professor Hsu's lab, which I think is outstanding and has helped us immensely. Modeling is still, I would say, not well understood. It's difficult to do deterministic models, let alone models that have such statistical variation as would an array of these nanotubes with billions of them per square centimeter. And then lastly, we've shown that thermal conductance through dry carbon nanotube arrays can approach that of bonded metals. And so that's a very compelling case for using these arrays in practice. Lastly, I'd like to acknowledge a number of people and entities. First, the students, Barakola, Jun Shu, who's actually a former student who's now at Honeywell working on thermal interfaces, and Sriharsha Aradhya, faculty Sean Fan Shu and Suresh Garamella. And then funding sources include the Cooling Technologies Research Center at Purdue, National Science Foundation, the Air Force Research Lab, NASA, Intel, and Nanoconduction. I thank them all.